I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner drove up to Capitol Hill today, stepped out of his test electric car, the Chevy Volt, to a bevy of reporters, and apologized for asking for help from taxpayers to save the auto industry. The humbled CEOs of GM, Ford, and Chrysler are in Washington to plead for a second time with the Senate Banking Committee, and this time for more money, up to $34 billion, to avoid going bankrupt. Last month, Committee Chair Christopher Dodd derided CEOs for traveling to Washington in corporate jets, but today he came out in favor of helping them. Micheline Maynard joins us now. She's been covering the auto industry, of course, for the New York Times. Mickey, is there a shift happening towards a bailout, away from letting these companies go bankrupt, which we were told by analysts would, you know, give the government more transparency and an ability to reorganize the companies?
Well, the automakers are making their best case for a bailout, and their case is essentially that at least one of them, General Motors, will run out of money by the end of this month. So they're making their best effort. As far as support, though, for a bailout, that's very unclear, and I think the hearings on Thursday and Friday are paramount to them actually being able to get federal assistance.
Yeah, today and tomorrow. Well, what else is GM doing? Because your newspaper paints a picture of a company desperately trying to sell its debt and restructure itself to avoid a bankruptcy judge doing it.
Well, there are a number of steps. One of the things that General Motors is doing is it's asking its bondholders to exchange those bonds for stock in the company. And, you know, in an earlier time when General Motors was a $70 stock, that might be sort of a no-brainer. But General Motors stock has been trading between about $3 and $5 over the last couple of weeks. And I think there is definitely some risk involved in that. Standard & Poor's, the big ratings agency, actually cut its rating on General Motors this morning, even deeper into junk bond status.
So they're going to have a hard time going that route, trying to sell their debt.
Well, it's very difficult for all of them right now. And I have to be honest, I've covered the auto industry a long time, and I never thought I would see Ford stock selling for, you know, $2 a share. We were joking that, you know, people would say that bottled water was more expensive than gasoline. Well, now it's more expensive than stock in the Detroit car companies.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, what is your sense? I mean, I know you're not going to, you know, give a verdict now, but, you know, people are so angry about these CEOs' salaries. We're going to talk about that in a second, about them traveling to Washington last week in the corporate jets. The Detroit Free Press editorials this week are exasperated. They write, "Hey, Congress, you wanted plans, you got plans. You want more answers, just ask. And then get over the corporate jets, get back into session, do the right thing for the country." You know, which way do you think this is tilting? Is the money going to come?
I think even the Detroit companies were surprised at the venom that was thrown at them over the last couple of weeks. And in the court of public opinion, we quoted, I believe, a poll by CNN that showed 60% of Americans oppose a bailout for the car companies. And that's a good question about, if you bail out the car companies, who's next? Which industries will get in line? And banks are one thing, because the value of your mortgage, if, you know, if your home falls apart, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars. A car is, you know, $20,000 or $30,000, and you've got other places to go.
Yeah, and just very briefly, Mickey, because we're going to have you back, what are you hearing today? For instance, Alabama Republican Richard Shelby, he's in a state that has foreign car factories. What has he said so far today to the big three?
He's essentially said that he still opposes the bailout. And I think what we're going to find is that, you know, some of the Republicans might be swayed, but there may not be enough support on both sides of the aisle this time to pass any legislation over the next week or so.
We heard one moment when he drew some laughs when he mused, "I wonder if they're going to drive back to Detroit." Everyone will have their eye on the CEOs. That's Mickey Maynard. She writes about the auto industry for the New York Times. And Mickey, stay right there, because we want you back later in the program to talk about your article today. And ask, do you think General Motors drew its own car division, Saturn, into the ground? And was that supposed to be GM's future? So we'll have Mickey Maynard back for that, okay? The CEOs from Ford, GM, and Chrysler are taking a page from Lee Iacocca circa 1979. You remember Iacocca, the former Chrysler CEO, offered to work for just about a dollar a year to win approval for a government bailout. If today's CEOs actually follow through on their pledge, they'll survive. General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner's salary was almost $16 million in 2007. Ford's Alan Mulally brought in almost $23 million, and that doesn't count the stock options. Remember, at the November hearings, Mulally was asked if he thought he should take a pay cut. His response?
I think I'm okay where I am.
Okay. Is there any other way to rein in CEOs' salaries besides threatening to withhold bail money, as we said, bailout money, rather, as we said, Alan Mulally has changed his tune? Should there be external forces cutting salaries, or should it all be market-driven? Paul Hodgson is with the Corporate Library in Portland, Maine. They track executive pay. And, Paul, first of all, what do you think of these dollar-a-year pledges? Do they work? Won't executives get money elsewhere?
Well, there have been a number of examples of executives undertaking the dollar-a-year salary over the years, often in conjunction with cost-cutting exercises, you know, to kind of share the pain piece of symbolism, really, from the CEO. If I'm going to cut your salary, at least they can do is to cut mine as well. And actually, we did a piece of research earlier this year whereby some CEOs have it written into their contracts that they will undertake a salary reduction as long as it's an across-the-board salary reduction that's being experienced by other employees and other executives at the company.
Huh.
But typically it's the CEO who takes that kind of figurehead position and takes a dollar a year. But as you said, you know, it's the salary that's affected, not necessarily all of the other bits and pieces right. that come with typical executive compensation packages.
Well, and that's what's getting people very angry, because there are all these other ways that CEOs and top execs are being paid. And everyone seems to agree that the system broke on Wall Street, that the huge salaries encouraged people to take risks on junk mortgages, make it look like there was a bigger bottom line. But what happened on Main Street? I mean, we know cars weren't selling. So how did car company CEOs still make so much?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Rick Wagoner's compensation, you know, has been lower over the past couple of years. But that has not been the case for Alan Mulally at Ford, because he's a new CEO. They had to pay him a lot of money to come and work for them. And, you know, typically if you hire somebody in from outside, it costs anywhere between 3 and 4 times as much to hire them as it does to, you know, if you have a succession plan in place. So he was kind of an expensive hire for Ford, so that's why his compensation seems relatively high.
Well, but what can and should be done from here on out? You know, people are talking about pay caps or clawbacks. These are requirements that CEOs, consultants, top execs give back money when their leadership fails. What's your thinking?
Well, you know, the idea of a pay cap is one that was kind of pushed out in the 90s by the Clinton administration when it introduced the kind of tax legislation that put a cap on any fixed compensation of $1 million. And if you wanted to pay above that, then it had to be performance-related. And, you know, that was the idea there, that maybe people would reduce their total compensation to $1 million or keep it within those bounds. But what in fact happened was that a lot of base salaries moved up to $1 million, and compensation above that, they just ensured that it was performance-related as it was defined within the tax code. So you have you had a kind of reverse consequences situation from that legislation. So I'm not sure that legislation coming from Congress in terms of a pay cap is going to have the desired effect. It often has the opposite effect of what is intended.
You mean, you know, sort of money coming from all other places to
right.
to raise
right.
the overall salary.
Yeah, I mean, executive compensation is kind of like a it's like a balloon. You squeeze it in the middle, and it'll swell out to the either end. And you squeeze it at one end, and it'll get fatter at the other end.
Well, some people, including a Professor Rajaram Rajan at the University of Chicago, are proposing that there is some sort of government requirement that, for instance, that especially with the government investing in some of these companies with bailouts, but requiring that banks can pay their executives, for instance, whatever they like, as long as they set aside more capital than we know banks have. That's one suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
And another is that the government strictly regulate compensation formulas. Now, you spoke about formulas and said that there's ways to get around them, but if there was more regulation, might those gaps be plugged up?
I doubt it, because the problem with the legislation is as soon as you put legislation into place, then the lawyers begin to work on ways to get around that, you know, whether it's tax legislation or whether it's, you know, some other kind of legislation. So I really don't think it's the way ahead. The way ahead, from my point of view, mm-hmm. As an observer of this, is that what really needs to be done is to get boards to change the way that they think about executive compensation. and not to look at everybody else and say, well, that's what Joe down the road gets paid, so we need to pay that to our CEO, but actually to think about it from their individual company point of view and to design a compensation package that actually incentivizes an executive to do what they want him to do.
Well, there's a problem there, isn't there? Because many of these CEOs serve on the boards. They're all friends.
Right, right. There is a certain amount of interlock, and there needs to be an expansion of the kind of people who are on board, certainly. But, you know, that's part of a potential solution. The problem with Wall Street is that all of the incentive compensation, salaries weren't particularly high on Wall Street. That wasn't the issue. But the rest of the compensation was all based on the last 12 months' results. And if all you're thinking about is the next 12 months, then why would you care that the company's going down the drain and you're taking excessive risks? Because taking those excessive risks allows you to hit that revenue target or that net income target in 12 months, and if the company collapses, well, so be it. Mm. Well, I mean, they were inoculated against loss, basically, by the amount of compensation that they'd already received.
Right. Well, what about the idea, though, of ensuring that banks and companies have better capital? I mean, one of the things that we've seen is that all this money went to huge salaries, but there was nothing left in the kitty.
Well, I mean, you know, I was talking to some clients yesterday, and I'd taken along the Lehman Brothers compensation discussion and analysis section from the proxy statement as a kind of case study. And one of the things that they were bragging about in there is that they'd kept their compensation expense down to 49.3% of their net revenues. And that was a claim to fame, because some of the banks had gone as high as 60% of their net revenues they were spending on compensation. And this was to reward, you know, those people who were making the decisions that have led to the collapse of the company. And it seemed incredible to me that, you know, you could have a situation whereby this was part of a business model, that you spent almost half of your net revenues on rewarding people who were generating those revenues. Hmm. So, you know, it was a business model that was bound to fail.
And just one last brief question. Do you think that CEOs, executives should be forced to give some money back, clawed back, if, in fact, there's no performance?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of – we've done some research to identify those companies that have these clawback provisions in place. And actually, you know, there's a very significant minority of companies that have it. It's more common amongst larger companies in the S&P 500. But many of them have them in place for fraudulent activity. So it's if the executive engages in fraudulent activity, that's when incentives will be clawed back. It's not when there's been poor performance. And, you know, that's a much more difficult thing to design and to put into place. Mm-hmm. But I think the boards need to think about it.
Paul Hodgson, senior researcher at the Corporate Library in Maine. Paul, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, back to cars. Just ahead, remember the Saturn? It was GM's shining star 25 years ago. It was supposed to be the company's future. What happened? We'll be back with Mickey Maynard of the New York Times. GM is now thinking about selling the brand, but did GM also kill it? And later, an egg farmer who says a new California law will kill his business. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. New York Times business reporter Micheline Maynard is back with us. She's been following the hearings in Washington, D.C. with the CEOs of the big three automakers. But we also want to talk about a little car, the Saturn. Remember the buzz about the Saturn 25 years ago? Happy employees. We saw them in commercials. It was General Motors' hope for the future. But now GM is considering selling it off, even though the Saturn Aura midsize sedan was named the 2007 North American Car of the Year. So what happened? Mickey Maynard, I'm so glad you wrote about this today in the Times, because I've had people stop me on the streets and say, you should do something about how GM killed Saturn. Did GM kill Saturn, or do you think it's more complicated than that?
Well, it's a complicated story, but I think what it comes down to is there was a leader, Roger Smith, who invented Saturn, and there was a UAW vice president, Don Eflin, who saw the need for a different kind of a contract as well as a different kind of a car. But when both of them were out of office, their successors really weren't that interested. They both saw Saturn as kind of a threat to the way General Motors was and to the way the union was.
Well, this you speak of GM, then GM chair Roger Smith, who created Saturn in the 1980s. And how was it to reinvent the way car companies did business? For instance, how was tell us about how the Saturn employees were treated.
You know, the Saturn employees were truly involved in company decision-making. And, you know, I went down there from the very beginning and looked at it, and there was actually an office at Saturn where they would invite other companies to come in, and they would give them lectures on the Saturn way and how they could institute it at their companies. And you would have speakers from the UAW, you would have speakers from the General Motors side, and it was sort of like you couldn't tell who was who because they were all wearing golf shirts and khaki pants.
This is in Spring Hill, Tennessee, where the plant was, and it was, as you write, a philosophy of respect, teamwork, communication from the factory floor to the auto showroom. But also, I've been told, a different kind of car. I don't get some of this, but you know, plastic in some places that made it better in some ways, parts that were interlocked that made it better in some ways, you know, other aspects too.
It was really just a small car. I mean, there was nothing tremendously remarkable about the Saturn itself, but it had some features that were aimed at dealing with some problems that customers encountered. For example, shopping carts that would ram into the side of your car, it had these dent-proof plastic panels on the side, so if something bumped into you, you wouldn't have to take it to the repair shop. And there was a peppy little engine in the car that got very good gas mileage for the time, and I think that more importantly than that, it was sort of this image of Saturn is something that we listened to you and we gave you, the customer, what you were looking for.
Yeah, and everybody did that. And the UAW Workers Union gave up some of their traditional restrictions to help the company succeed. And it in the beginning, we understand it really worked. Saturn did what it was supposed to do in luring Americans away from Hondas and Toyotas.
I've actually had conversations with people at both Honda and Toyota, and they said that when Saturn came out, they watched their buyers go to Saturn. I believe something like 60% of the original Saturn owners traded either a Honda or a Toyota, and it really was on the path to being the import fighter that Roger Smith envisioned it to be.
Yeah, it was on the cover of Time. Can America Still Compete, says the headline, with its new Saturn. GM bets the answer is yes. And then what?
Very interestingly, Saturn was almost a victim of its own success. It was a very expensive project for General Motors. They spent about $5 billion to start the company, build the plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee, which is just outside Nashville, and also get the car up and going and staff the dealerships, that kind of thing. At the time, General Motors in 1992 faced almost the kind of situation they're in right now. They were practically bankrupt. There was a crisis in what's called the commercial paper market, and they couldn't get money to loan to dealers. So all the other old divisions at General Motors, like Buick and Pontiac and Cadillac, were saying, wait a minute, you've staffed this thing, you've spent all this money, what about us? We've been around far longer than this little upstart, and it's time for us to get some money as well. So at the same time, some of the UAW members at the Saturn plant were very uncomfortable about this idea of sharing power with a company. I mean, there had always been the adversarial relationship, and they were sitting there, and instead of grievances being filed, they were supposed to sort this out in meetings and shake hands and be brothers, and that didn't sit well with them at all either.
Well, especially since, I mean, you know, maybe it was both sides were a little bit at fault there, but especially since, as you write, it wasn't the same management as it had been under Roger Smith. And so they weren't feeling as friendly towards the management and the management style. But slowly, and of course, the SUV, we forgot about the SUV. The SUV comes along and Americans start running to that. But do you think, I mean, is there a chance, what's the takeaway here, Mickey? Is there a chance that if GM had stayed with that, you know, this is our future, and not tried to placate cars that were so obviously becoming dinosaurs, if they had stayed with it, do you think there was a chance that they'd be better positioned today?
What they needed to do with Saturn was nurture it. In about the mid-90s, it needed a little bit bigger car, and it would have needed an SUV, and it eventually got them, but it got them about a decade too late. I think as far as the UAW relationship was concerned, it works when you have people who support it and who implement it, but if you sort of let the old traditions come back, you're going to lose the belief in that. I absolutely do think that Saturn holds the keys to what General Motors should become, but you have to have people with strong belief.
And who might buy Saturn?
Well, Saturn would be very attractive to, say, a Chinese company or an Indian company or even one of the Japanese or German brands. You know, Daimler Chrysler was supposed to be Mercedes' opportunity to sell mass market cars in the United States, and the Chrysler part of it didn't work very well. I don't know if Daimler really wants to buy in another American brand, but there's certainly an opportunity. At one point, the UAW leadership at Saturn wanted to spin off Saturn and run it themselves, and the GM board told them no. Maybe they could get back together and make an offer.
Well, and whoever gets it will have what one of your analysts calls the best undiscovered car in America. Again, this is the Saturn Aura. It makes your stomach turn a little bit. That's Mickey Maynard, New York Times business reporter, who writes about the failed promise of GM's Saturn in today's paper. Mickey, thanks as always.
Oh, my pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
And tomorrow in Here and Now, of course, we'll keep an eye on the hearings in Washington, but we're also going to speak to an NGO worker just back from Haiti about rebuilding a community after a hurricane. What was that like? And we're also going to take a second look at The Man. That's the 64 novel by Irving Wallace about the nation's first black president way back in 1964. Still ahead, all the news here and now. What's been the effect of the November referendums? We've been taking an occasional look at the impact of November's ballot questions. Today, California's Proposition 2. Now, this measure had to do with animal welfare. It overwhelmingly passed, and that means California now bans all confining crates and cages for farm animals. Or, as the Los Angeles Times put it in a headline, Proposition 2, good for chickens, bad for chicken farmers. Hens are the most widely affected. By law, they now have to be able to stand up, turn around, and spread their wings without touching each other or a cage. Arizona and Florida have similar animal welfare laws. In Florida, the two pig farms that were affected went out of business. In Arizona, the one animal farm affected upgraded, and it's still open. But what will happen in California with huge egg farms that are affected and have until 2015 to comply? Ryan Armstrong is a third-generation egg farmer at the 60-year-old Armstrong Egg Farm in San Diego County. Their caged birds can stand up and turn around, but the cages are about 16 square inches for two birds, about 24 square inches for up to seven, so they do touch each other. And Ryan, we understand that the small amount of free-range birds, cageless birds you have, don't have the space required by the new law. So what does this new law mean for you?
Well, it's the beginning of the end of the egg business in California. It puts restrictions on the egg farmers here in California that no other farmer in the U.S. has to deal with. So, you know, it'll increase the cost to produce the eggs here. And so what happens is anytime we're not on a level playing field with outside of California, they'll sell the eggs in here for cheaper.
Well, but proponents of this measure say, first of all, that more and more people are demanding cage-free birds. Wolfgang Puck, who you well know, who's a restaurateur, says that he will not use eggs from caged hens. Major chains like Denny's, Carl's Jr., Hardee's, all demanding cage-free hens' eggs. Colleges and corporate cafeterias, you know, there have been campaigns. So, you know, proponents of this new ban are saying they're just trying to get the egg industry positioned for what the demand is going to be.
Well, the proponents of Prop 2 have gone to those places and lobbied to get them to buy cage-free. And even like the majors like Burger King came out and said that they'll buy cage-free. But their contract says they only have to buy like 2% cage-free.
Well, back to your problem with, you know, the fact that your hens do touch each other when they spread their wings. Why can't you just acquire a little bit more land and spread them out just a little bit more?
Acquiring more land, it just adds more cost. And I've talked to two of the largest suppliers of cage-free in California, and they distribute across the nation, and they have too many cage-free. Demand has gone down because of the extra cost in those eggs. You can go to any grocery store across the nation and find cage-free eggs versus cage eggs, and they just cost more.
Well, let's take a look at some of your costs that you might accrue. We understand that you feel you'd have to add 300 more acres of land and invest as much as $15 million in improvements to your farm. Again, you've got 600,000 birds, and that might cost about $30 a bird to create new housing for them?
Yes, and we have systems, cage systems, that aren't paid for. There's a majority of California farmers that have invested into the caged egg business, and now they're having to tear all those out and throw them all away and put in new cage-free systems in an environment where, you know, nobody's happy to lend any money these days.
Well, you know, it sounds as if you're really struggling and you feel that the family farm might go under. But then we're also hearing from the Sacramento area farmer, Nigel Walker. His farm isn't small. It's about 65 acres. Yours is about 100. And he says that abiding by the new laws is eminently doable. He allows his hens to roam in pastures.
How many chickens does he have?
Well, he has 3,000. And how many do you have?
We have 600,000 birds, so we can feed about, you know, about 600,000 people. You know, he can't supply enough food for the town that he lives in.
So you feel that you have a requirement, a responsibility to supply to meet the demands upon you for food, and that means...
Well, we're dealing with a different customer base. He's dealing with a niche market that people with expendable income that are willing to pay more for that premium egg. You know, farmers in general deal with the regular public that have to feed their families. 95% of the eggs are bought by people who just want a safe, economical source of protein.
Well, in fact, Nigel Walker's customers pay him $7 a dozen for his eggs.
Okay, there you go. If we charge consumers $7 a dozen, and somebody in Iowa or Mexico comes out and says, well, I'll sell mine for $1.99.
Would it be better? I mean, this is a state proposition, a state law. Would the playing field be more even if this was a federal law?
You know, the real problem is it's not better for the birds.
That's so counterintuitive because for centuries people had chickens and hens and they roamed freely and, you know, had feed thrown to them and they did just fine. And you know, the thinking on the part of a lot of vegetarians is that animals that are caged are anxious and that anxiety and the hormones that anxiety produces go into the food that you eat. So it's healthier for everyone when the animals are free. But you say no.
No, and you know, you can talk to any veterinarian. The ones that deal with poultry will tell you that there's pros and cons to each system. But the birds themselves, as far as physical health, are healthier in a caged environment, mostly because we get them out of the disease that's in the feces that they're walking in. Salmonella's in the feces, and on a small scale in the backyard, you know, you can monitor that. But when you're, the more chickens we put in these houses, the more we deal with the problems associated with volume of producing those eggs. You know, in California, we're the number one consumer of eggs in the nation, so we have to produce the most eggs we can. In cage-free environments, they don't lay as many eggs because they are more stressed. You know, cannibalism is probably the number one cause of mortality in cage-free systems. You know, they end up fighting over breakfast.
Well, is it possible that you're looking at a future where you have to adjust to smaller farming, Ryan, where maybe you can't do 600,000 chickens?
You know, the problem is somebody has to produce the eggs. Nobody is going into the egg business. So 5 years ago, there were more farmers than there are today. So at some point, we get less and less farmers, but we require more and more food.
Well, but right now, this new law requires that you give your birds more space. Do you think you're going to be able to survive?
No. I know I've met with a lot of farmers these last couple weeks, and the majority of them are just like, well, we have farms outside of California, and we'll just shut down the ones here and ship the eggs in from outside of California.
Well, Ryan Armstrong, you're looking at a several-generation family farm, and obviously that's of great concern. But do you have any, I mean, do you ever have moments of thinking, well, it would be idyllic if the animals, you know, can rove around? I mean, do you have some sympathy with the animal activists who, you know, have concern about the cage?
Our employees that work with the caged birds, they'll go in and eat the caged eggs because they think they're a healthier, cleaner egg.
But what about the birds themselves? And that's what I guess I'm saying. Do you have any moments where you think, well, that is a tough life to be live in a cage? And
you know, they're in a cage and they don't have as much room as I personally would like, but they're not mistreated either. You know, you could talk to anybody that's come out to our farm, and we've had a lot of people out there, and they've all said the same thing. They go, well, where's the bad stuff? there isn't anything bad. It's just farming.
That's Ryan Armstrong, a third-generation egg farmer in San Diego County in California. Well, Ryan, thanks so much for speaking with us, and best to you.
Thank you.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts. This is all something to think about while you eat, maybe, eggs. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org. And you're listening to Here and Now. High technology knows no borders, and that's also true of a charitable organization that connects patients from poor developing countries with specialists in more advanced countries through email. Doctors with, say, an accident victim in Bangladesh can send photos and texts to participating specialists in countries like the U.S. and Britain, who then email back their recommendations. The Swinfen Charitable Trust is in its 10th year, and we wanted to find out more about how it works, so we called Pat Swinfen. She and her husband, Roger, run the trust in England. And as you'll hear, even though it's very high tech, it's also very low overhead. Pat, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Robin. Thank you very much for asking me.
And, you know, I understand that you're just there in your home. I mean, this is a comfy home that you work out of.
Yes. I'm sitting watching my husband working on the computer at the moment in our very untidy sitting room.
But from here, you travel to Nepal and to Bangladesh, as we said, to so many countries that need help. It's really quite something and so simple. Tell us about this telemedicine. This is medicine, well, is it the kind we're talking about?
It's very simple. It's medicine at a distance.
Well, you and your husband come up with the idea of using email. You have 400 specialists now that you can consult with and 140 countries where doctors know they can get in touch with you. Who have you heard from?
We have doctors in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Cambodia, East Timor, Antarctica, for heaven's sake. Need I go on?
What are some of the problems that they have that their doctors need help with?
They have all sorts of problems, some of them perfectly ordinary problems. It's quite interesting to note that when there's a huge disaster like the tsunami or the earthquake in Kashmir, once these little field hospitals are set up, very often by a country's armed forces, into those field hospitals come people with perfectly ordinary problems, but people who have perhaps never seen a doctor in their lives. And they come in with things like ear, nose and throat problems, or a leg which has perhaps an ulcer on it, or a scar which is troubling them. In a disaster, it isn't all disaster trauma medicine. It can be quite innocuous things.
We understand you've had to track down the specialists that, you know, provide the answers on treks in Nepal, and I'm sure you find them in operating rooms, but they respond. And this doesn't cost these doctors who need help a dime?
It doesn't cost them anything except the cost of sending an email.
Well, how sustainable is this?
Well, we spend our lives, my husband and I spend our lives, appealing for donations. And we've got some very good friends who, down through the years, send us small sums of money, which enables us to buy the digital cameras and the tripods to send to these doctors if they need a digital camera. Not all of them need that.
But this is just so that they can take pictures of
this
the injury?
This is so that they can take pictures of a wound or a child who has something perhaps wrong with its spine. And even if they haven't got an X-ray machine, they can photograph the child's back so that you can see pretty well on the pictures what is actually wrong with the spine.
Well, we understand since you started in 1998, you've helped almost 1,800 cases, saved many lives. Is there one that, I mean, I'm sure there are many, but is there one you want to share with us that just sort of sticks out?
There's one that really does stick out. The case came in the day following Christmas Day, and it was one of these cases that was answered within a half an hour. The lady had been in a wheelchair for 18 years. She'd never been able to work, and somebody had to look after her. She was aged 48. And the neurologist who took on this case, in fact, set up an email dialogue with the doctor in charge of the case. And they worked on this for 7 months. And by July, they'd got the lady out of her wheelchair, walking with a stick, and she's now, for the first time in her life, got a job And her daughter's got a job because she doesn't have to look after her mother anymore.
All over email. That's Pat Swinfen speaking about the trust that she and her husband Roger run. It's called the Swinfen Charitable Trust, based in England. But they reach out to developing countries who need medical help and hook them up with specialists in countries like Britain and the U.S. Pat, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
Thank you very much, Robin, for asking me.
And as we said from her living room, I think we just heard her dogs barking there. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back. In Elizabeth Strout's collection of short stories, we meet the title character, Olive Kitteridge, slowly. In the first story, Olive is the infrequently glimpsed and blunt-speaking wife of pharmacist Henry Kitteridge. You wonder why the lovely Henry stays with her, but as he says, to leave Olive would be as unthinkable as sawing off his leg. Their son is named Chris.
Olive can understand why Chris has never bothered having many friends. He's like her that way, can't stand the blah, blah, blah. And they'd just as soon blah, blah, blah about you when your back is turned. Never trust folks, Olive's mother told her years ago after someone left a basket of cow flaps by their front door. Henry got irritated by that way of thinking, but Henry was pretty irritating himself with his steadfast way of remaining naive, as though life were just what a Sears catalog told you it was, everyone standing around smiling.
In the second story, we learn that Olive was once a teacher. She happens to show up as a former student contemplates suicide. In the third story, Olive appears in a cameo as a patron in the local bar, a wave of a hand, and she's gone. But through 13 tales, a complex picture of Olive emerges, like a Polaroid developing. When this book was first published earlier this year, both the New York Times and the New Yorker gave Olive Kitteridge rave reviews. USA Today called it glorious, powerful stuff. We concur and thought now that it's out in paperback, we'd reprise our conversation with author Elizabeth Strout. How would you describe Olive? Who is she? A part of her is Maine, we should say. Her blunt speaking is Putney.
Yes, I think that she is a product of where she comes from, which is many generations of that have produced Olive Kitteridge on the coast of Maine. So she does have a bluntness. She does have a certain personality that almost aligns itself with the cragginess of the coastline itself.
The and the clipped speech.
Yeah.
And as the Times said, the clucking of communal disapproval. She has a little of that, sort of.
Oh, absolutely. She has a great deal of of different disapprovals. Yes.
But what else would you say about her?
I think of Olive as being quite ferocious in her needs and unapologetic in going about getting what she needs in a way that makes her stand out as a rather powerful character and in many ways, I think, recognizable to ourselves, although hopefully we're not quite as direct and forthright about what we need and how blind one can be, she can be, we can be, to the pain that we cause others.
And yet, she is, grossly overweight herself, but she weeps over a young girl who's got anorexia.
Absolutely. She's a strange combination, as I think many people are. She's very sensitive to the needs of others. However, those are people generally that are not as close to her.
Right.
The closer you get to Olive, the more her needs will consume you.
Or that she can't express to you appropriately what
exactly.
her needs are. She loves her son but drives him away. She
right.
puts her husband down at every opportunity, but thinking of him gone squeezes her heart so hard. She felt like a package of vacuum-packed coffee. Her heart has been stopped by events in her life.
Absolutely. The accumulation of losses has been something that has brought her great, great sorrow. And she does have heart. She has a fierce heart that can feel for people in all directions. But she's very intense, and her heartache is intense.
Yeah. Well, and we don't want to give away too much of the stories because there's so many of them, and we get just a little bit from each one. But having to do with a father who said to her years earlier, sometimes I feel like ending it all. And she says, oh, Dad, sometimes we all feel that way. Well,
right. And then she has to live. And then she lives with that. And that's a, unspeakably terrible thing.
Yeah, terrible
for
loss.
For anybody to have to go through. And it obviously has made its mark on her.
And is that, a parent's suicide? Is that what sometimes shuts off her heart?
I think so. I think that it was a blow that was so large, and she, with her particular background and her time that she's living in, current time, she's really unable to understand the depth of that blow to herself and the effect that it's going to have throughout her life on others as well as herself.
Why did you introduce her to us this way? Why did you do it through these short stories? She's not even in some of them.
Right. It came to me unconsciously. The first story that I wrote of Olive was the first marriage of her son. And I think that I understood right away that she's such a forceful character that the reader is going to kind of need a break. And I saw it episodically more than in a traditionally layered kind of novel. And so it developed that way. It wasn't completely deliberate. It really was sort of unconscious that I would just write these different stories about Olive. And then I realized that it, for me anyway, I think it has the heft of a novel when you put it all together. And I'm very interested in point of view. So I love the chance to see her through the eyes of other people in the community, some who know her well, some who don't know her as well.
That's the magnificent part of this, because you find yourself thinking, oh, next time I go to Maine or anywhere, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're looking around, and that woman walking down an alley at night with her hand on the wall might have had a few drinks to steady herself
right.
so she can play at the piano at the bar.
Right.
And she might cross an intersection, and Olive might cross the other
Absolutely.
Way. And they have these... There's an interconnectedness
yeah.
that you start to realize that people in the background of a scene might be in the foreground
right.
the next day.
Right. That was very fun for me to do that, to give so-called minor characters the center stage every so often and to see, you know, what their life was like. And then to get that glimpse of Olive as opposed to having a full front view that we have in the other stories.
Well, the other thing it does is it reminds you of the thing that Olive doesn't seem to really see. Well, you know what? Maybe I'm not sure anyone does. I mean, we're all the stars in our own play, but you realize in the way you've told this is that everybody is. I mean, Olive may be the star of the book, but everybody comes forward.
That's right. That's right. Everybody is the star of their own show, and everybody's inner universe is their main focal point, and we see the others as they pass by us, and that's always interested me so much. And so to be able to use it in this book in that way was really gratifying.
I'm wondering... You know, we're here in Boston, we're heard across the country, but, you know, perhaps there's someone up in Maine or New Hampshire, you know, that you'd rather not hear the answer to this, but was there someone, some prickly person who was sort of unlikable that helped draw you into this character, you know? There's got to be something there to that person that is unlikable.
Well, I come from many generations of Maine. I think on one side there's 8 generations, on the other side there's 10. That's a lot of ancestry if you add it up. And so... Even though I have lived outside the state of Maine for many, many years, this is a part of my background. These are characters or a compilation of different characters that I've known, certainly in my childhood, and just a kind of understanding, especially having lived away from Maine, I have a different looking back on it or when I go up to visit. You know, I see that, you know, all regions have their own signatures, and so this character came from many experiences and many people that had passed my way.
People who had what, as you said, become like the landscape?
People who don't mince their words, people who are not particularly concerned with the niceties and will say what they perceive to be the truth.
Well, that's Olive Kittredge.
Yes.
And in the final analysis, again, we're not going to give it away, but, you know, really tells the truth about herself.
Yes, she does. Too. If there's one thing you can say about Olive, she's pretty truthful. She has blind spots about herself, as we all do, but she's pretty truthful about...
Yeah, in the end.
In the end.
Do you want people to like Olive?
I've been around with this book now, going around, and it's been quite amazing how many different responses there are. Many people will come up to me and whisper, I'm like Olive. Or they might come up and say, my wife is like Olive. Other people say, you know, she's a little too hard to take. But I have been very surprised that many, many people end up liking her. I think the most common thing I've heard is, I didn't like her at the beginning of the book. By the end of the book, I missed her dreadfully and I loved her. And I really want them to feel whatever they feel. The book belongs to them at this point.